Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Surprise Jeb Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Kruger, surprising you with new topics every single week and jabbing you with your daily dose of UFC. And we are back with another UFC event this weekend and a lot more surprises in store for you on today's episode. I mean, another UFC event. Final Apex event for the month, I believe, although we only have one more UFC event after UFC Vegas 99, which we'll be dropping our predictions for, giving a little card preview on today's episode. And then we go to the Apex November 9th, I believe, and then the rest of the year we have crowds, thank goodness. Our next Apex event will be in January, so we do have some time before we sadly have to deal with that, because I'm not a fan of these Apex cards, although they haven't been too bad. On today's episode as well, we'll be dropping our Week 7 quick picks for the NFL, new things in pop culture, new UFC news, and I'm going to be giving my official review of Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. I finally finished the show. It took me a while. I kind of took a break here and there, but I was on a little binge. You know, I was watching Reacher. I was watching The Jinx. We reviewed both of those on the last episode of the Surprise Jeb Podcast. Go check that out, episode 130. But on today, we will be looking at the Monsters, the Menendez brothers. And I actually found out that Charlie Hunnam or whatever, amazing actor. He was in Sons of Anarchy. He was in like Arthur, King of the Sword or whatever. He's playing the next serial killer in the next monster show, however it works. But let's get into things. We won't talk too much about randomness, although I am excited, actually. I got my book. My book I've been waiting to come out. It's called Fury of the Gods. It's the third and final book in the Bloodsworn trilogy by John Gwynn. I have been waiting for that book to come out, so I'm just a little excited. Any book lovers out there, I recommend that if you're looking for a little fictional book to escape reality. But we're here to discuss new UFC news to start things off. As always, it's how we kick off every single episode. So just about, and we don't really have any new fight announcements. I will say the one announcement, unfortunately, is that Lerone Murphy is out of his matchup against Dan Ige for UFC 308 coming up. Dan Ige is the number 14th ranked men's featherweight, Lerone at number 12, taking his place will be Jean Lord Silva, who has been on an absolutely insane run. He just knocked out Drew Dober on short notice. He has been an absolute killer. He's knocked out Charles Jourdain as well. Very scary man. Dan Ige is just taking hitters everywhere he can get them. Taking on Diego Lopez, taking on Jean Silva now. It has been tough goings for Dan Ige. You know, you get one big knockout of Andre Feely to start off the year, and this is where you end up. So I don't really want to say I feel bad, because you know he's still accepting the fight, but just the run that Dan Ige is on of fighting tough competitors has been just utterly ridiculous. I wonder if we can actually see his resume, because it's been pretty wild. I can't believe that fight fell apart. Yeah, he's had to fight Bryce Mitchell. I mean, Nate Landwehr proved to be a tough fight. Ozvar Evlov, he's had to fight Josh Emmett, Chan Sung Jung. The run that he's been on has been pretty generational. But Dan Ige, I wish him luck against Jean Silva. We'll have to see how he does. In other words, UFC 312 going down February 9th officially has a home, and it is Sydney, Australia. Exciting stuff. Hashtag Feel New Sydney is the hashtag they'll be running with. Some fighters you can expect to see, probably Kai Kara France, you know, after this whole aftermath of the flyweight division has cleared up. Kai Kara France should be on that card. Jack Della Maddalena, the return of the top five men's welterweight, could potentially be getting a title shot. Who knows? Tai Tuivasa also will probably be given one more shot in the UFC, I can presume. Robert Whittaker could potentially be fighting Dricus du Plessis for a title shot. We'll have to see. The return of Alexander Volkanovski, the return of Steven Ersik. I'm excited. I hope they load this card up. But yes, UFC 312 in Sydney. UFC 311 in January, I do believe, is rumored for Los Angeles. I don't know if that's true. We will have to see. Another news, Mike Perry, former UFC fighter, bare knuckle fighter, is fun and just about boxing a whole bunch, was arrested for DUI over this past weekend in Lake County. I believe he was in Florida. I did see the arrest footage, the officer's footage, and safe to say that Mike Perry is just always on one. I can't believe you got arrested for DUI. We do not support drunk driving. Mike Perry, there's a reason you're not in the UFC anymore. In other words, Tom Aspinall has officially been named the backup for UFC 309 between Stipe Miocic and Jon Jones in their heavyweight clash. Tom Aspinall, of course, the interim champion, the man who should be fighting Jon Jones. I really get this feeling, guys, that UFC 309, you are going to see Stipe pull out, and or maybe even John, you're going to see one of them pull out and Tom Aspinall being put into a position to potentially fight them, and they won't accept the fight. They've been holding on this fight for so long. It has been utterly ridiculous. I just want to see them fight. They're probably both going to... Actually, I don't even want to really see them fight. Am I going to watch it? Yes, but do I really want to see it? Not really. Not really. I want to see Tom Aspinall fight for a belt. That's what I want. Julia Pena says that Amanda Nunes wants to come back and face the winner of her versus Kayla Harrison when they fight for the Women's Bantamweight Championship. They believe that that fight will take place in June at International Fight Week. I do look forward to that, and I think that would make complete sense. Amanda Nunes was originally supposed to fight Julia Pena before she fought Irene Aldana and then retired. And of course, everyone was talking about Kayla Harrison and Amanda Nunes doing a super fight. I love that idea. Julia Pena actually cooking up some great ideas. Dustin Poirier recently says that he wants his retirement fight to happen in Louisiana, and I believe, not Dana White, but it might have been Hunter Campbell or Sean Shelby was saying that they are trying to get the UFC to go to Louisiana. It would probably be for a pay-per-view in the first quarter of 2025. Dustin Poirier recently said in an interview that he would love to have a trilogy fight with Justin Gaethje since they are both 1-1 and have each knocked each other out. I think that would be perfect, and I think it would be a great way for both of them to wrap up their careers. I mean, they have yet to ever win the official championship, one interim gold. I hope that fight happens. It'd be a great way to watch two guys and their career going at it. Maybe they end in a draw. Wouldn't that be something? Donald Cowboy Cerrone recently said that he wants to come back for two more fights so that he can break some UFC records by getting to 50 career fights or something like that. He was saying something about 50 career fights or 50 fights in the UFC. I don't think he's had 50 fights in the UFC. I could be wrong, but Cowboy Cerrone pushing. I think he's past 40 by now. I don't know if I want to see him come back to the UFC, but if he does, I think him versus Tony Ferguson would be a perfect fight. It would be so fitting to just watch one of those guys finally get a win. If that's going to be the case, I say we do Tony Ferguson versus Cowboy Cerrone. I'm actually down for that. And the final little UFC news that I will point out is that Michael Chandler recently said that his rematch with Charles Dobranc Oliveira in the co-main event at UFC 309 is going to be a number one contender's title fight. And as absurd as that sounds, that he could be getting a title shot after being off for 2 years, it's not really. You know, Chandler's six. Okay, Chandler is six. Dan Hooker's at five. Dan Hooker's only notable win as of late is Matheus Gamrot, who's already been bumped down to number nine. All right, Gaethje and Poirier are the 3 and 4, and it looks like they might be fighting, as I just mentioned. You also have Charles Oliveira at number 2, the only man that have beaten him, Armin Tsarukyan, is fighting Islam Makhachev, the champion, who also beat Oliveira. It kind of makes sense. It honestly really does make sense for me, and I just really hope it really takes place. And also, Dan Hooker was in, apparently him and Conor McGregor are going to be fighting February 1st in Saudi Arabia. I have no idea where that information came from. But oddly enough, you know, February 1st, I do believe it lands on a Saturday. It might even be a Friday. We'll have to see. Hooker says he's one fight away from the belt or something. All these guys want Conor McGregor. All these guys want the big fight. But who will eventually get it? I don't know. Still waiting for some new official fight announcements to take place, but we are happy when we can see any little bits of news here and there. Also, in the world, also in the news, as I was mentioning in our little introduction, is I was able to watch the hit show Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. 9 episodes this time. They're making me watch a lot more than Dahmer. But let me tell you, this show really just takes you one way, steers you another, brings you back in, steers you another way, and you never really know how you feel about it. First off, 9 out of 10, 9.5 out of 10. This was a phenomenal show. It really gets you hooked. I'm honestly going to say Dahmer was better. I honestly felt some form of connection to Dahmer. I felt this demonic energy at times. I felt this glimpse of hope at times. I felt the pain of the victims. I even felt Dahmer's, I felt sympathy for him. I could feel these emotions. In this show, you really just are confused, all right? By the way, praise Jesus. We do not like the demonic energy. I was just saying there were some scenes there where I was kind of like, yeah, I can feel there's a force working through this. And I don't really want to say I like that, but I can acknowledge that the film was able to do that. In this show, there's just a lot of confusion. There was a lot of confusion. And if I take it through, so 9 episodes, if no one knows the case, I mean, to dumb it down to the simplest form, Lyle and Eric Menendez shot their parents to death in 89? I think it was 1989. They were eventually convicted and sent to prison, and they've been in prison ever since. And that's kind of the basis of it. But the whole tale of it is just so odd. So you kick things off episode one, and it starts the show kind of similar to the Dahmer case. This one, it starts it with them killing their parents. All right, and it gives you the view of the brothers doing it, and, you know, in 1989, Lyle and Eric, they're taken into custody by the FBI temporarily following the murder of their parents, Jose and Kitty Menendez, in their Beverly Hills mansion, which they initially blame on the mob. Haunted by nightmares of his parents dying, Eric, the younger one, visits Dr. Jerome Oziel, who was their official, what do you call it, psychologist? What do they call it? Who did Tony Soprano see? A therapist. That was their therapist they were supposed to talk to. And he convinces that him and his brother were the ones that killed their parents. I mean, they were getting media attention because Jose Menendez was a big deal. And they mentioned how why they decided to do so is because their father was controlling and physically abusive while their mother, Kitty, was suicidal and addicted to drugs. That is what they told him. So it was they were serving justice for themselves by killing their father, and they were showing sympathy by killing their mother. Following the confession, Dr. Oziel calls Lyle into his office while calling his mistress, Judah Lawn. Crazy story there with Judah Lawn, who ended up actually signing with the boys. Very weird story there. To witness the confession at the office, Lyle denies that they killed the parents, and he leaves with Eric. But the weird thing is that after they killed their parents, they go on this spending spree, and it is just utterly ridiculous. As we get into episode two, it kind of talks about how after they killed them, they worked out a whole alibi. So it's like, as much as this was like justice that their father abused them, it was just very weird that they were out spending money. The brothers actually reported the murder. The police realized something was amiss, and then the brothers just spent a lot of money on luxury products. They were staring at the Beverly Hills like luxury suite, presidential suite. It was crazy. And then they also came up, I don't remember if this was in two or three, about the will and apparently how the boys have been out of the will, but then it turned out they were actually in the will. I mean, crazy. 2 months later, you know, after this whole spending spree, the police send one of Eric's friends to elicit a confession from him while Dr. Oziel continues with the brothers in therapy and offers them to be his business partner. But then Oziel throws Judalon out of his house, and in a fit of rage, he goes to the police station and tells them everything. So the actual arresting of the brothers took place when the mistress of the therapist that Eric had confessed to actually went to police because she was mad at Dr. Oziel. Crazy story. There, okay? So Judalon, we're getting to episode three, tells them all about it. All right, the police, they then go to Oziel's house, they confiscate all the info, and then they arrest the brothers. Now, the brothers have a hard time adjusting to new life in jail. It's pretty funny. They come from this rich lifestyle, and seeing them adjust to jail is pretty funny. Eric starts to befriend an inmate in there, and it's very odd how they really paint Eric as like bisexual, or like they really show like how gayness in this, which I think is just Netflix, but also they kind of touch on this later where Eric was actually dealing with some weird things with his sexuality due to a reason which happened in episode 5. We're going to be talking about episode 5 in just a moment. But yes, we're still on episode 3. The brothers, they're denying everything that's happened. Their lawyer, Robert Shapiro, reveals to them that they will be facing the death penalty after hearing that Eric considers telling the truth about his parents, but Lyle refuses. The guards then discover a plan by Lyle to escape, and they thus transfer him to a different cell away from his brother. After they fire Robert Shapiro as their lawyer, the family hires Leslie Abrahamson, and at the behest of Leslie, Eric tells William Vickery that he was sexually abused by Lyle, which was what Jose did to them. I can't remember who William Vickery was, but there's also, you know, Pepper Potts or whatever, Pepper from Modern Family? He's in this, and he plays a really good role, and I don't know, he works for, like, Vanity Fair or something, and he, like, kind of doesn't really like Leslie Abrahamson, who is the popular lawyer. It's lawyer for Eric, because I mean, it was kind of weird. She was representing Eric and Lyle. They both had separate lawyers, and they have a whole dynamic during this. And then episode 4, you know, Leslie, she visits Lyle to get his side of the story. They don't really want to portray their father as a monster, saying that he wanted the best for them, but the more you learn, he was super harsh on them, and just it was ridiculous. And then you find out that the brothers, they had actually been doing burglary and stealing things, and their father bailed them out. But then you learn that Lyle had been being abused by his father from a young age. Lyle actually abused Eric the same way, and then their father was still abusing Eric. you know, to normalize what was happening to him, he began abusing Eric, is basically what it was super weird. Lyle managed to get his father to stop abusing him, though he went on to abuse Eric. I mentioned that. After this, Lyle confronted his father and told Leslie that Jose planned to kill them. Dominic Dunn, that's Pepper Potts' name. What's that actual actor's name? What's his name? Dominic John Dunn was an American writer, investigative journalist, and producer. He began his career in film and studies. Okay, that's Dominic Dunn was the actual name of the guy. He's an enemy of Leslie's. He argues that the brothers are truly evil and do not deserve forgiveness. So up to this point, you're kind of confused. You're kind of siding with the brothers. And then you get into episode 5. And episode 5 is one of the craziest shot episodes I've ever seen. It is, who is it? Directed by Michael Uppendahl. Michael Uppendahl. And it was written by Ian Brennan. Okay, Ian Brennan, one of the executive producers on the show. Leslie visits Eric, and in a one-shot, one take, no cutaways, Eric tells her how his parents locked him up and how his father abused him. And in his opinion, his father only loved Lyle. And when Jose began to abuse him, he felt that was the only time in which his father really loved him. Although, like his brother Lyle, the abuse began from massages after tennis, which their father really pushed them in, to full-on rape, which according to his father was to make him strong, although for him it was torture. He believed that it was something the Spartans used to do to build bondage and to build strength. His mother was aware of all this and even began checking his penis as a teenager to see if he had contracted AIDS, since he was secretly having sexual relations with a man because of his experiences with his father. My touchback on the, you know, he couldn't really tell what his sexuality was. Finally, Eric tells Leslie that he had been a broken man ever since, and the episode is called The Hurt Man, and that's what he said he is. He's the hurt man, and the details of the stuff that he went through is just the objects inserted to him, the stuff his father would do to him, like poke needles into his penis and freaking, you know, he called things rough sex and soft sex and knees and mouth. It was horrible. And you're just like, Jose Menendez deserved what happened to him. And then you get into the 6, 7, 8, 9 episode run, and this is where your perception changes. And I just, for amazing work to Ryan Murphy directing this, because it really makes you question things. Episode 6, called Don't Dream It's Over, the shift focuses to the unraveling of the brothers' confessions. So the police have obtained Dr. Oziel's tapes, hear the brothers confessing to the murder of their parents. Lyle and Eric are then subsequently arrested and begin to confront the gravity of their situation as they adjust to life in jail. The episode further delves into their psychological state and the growing tension leading up to their trial. The episode isn't really shot in chronological order. It's shot in pieces. So, you know, you're going back in time, you're getting these scenarios, you're getting these interviews, and this episode just kind of fills that in. But you start to kind of get the switch where maybe the brothers are lying about some things. Like, I don't think they were lying about being abused, but they certainly were lying about other things. You get into episode 7, the switch continues. It's called Showtime. The trial of Lyle and Eric begins in earnest. The episode delves into the courtroom drama as both the prosecution and defense present their cases, and the defense does an excellent job here, okay? The brothers' legal team works to portray them as victims of sexual abuse, while the prosecution argues that the murders were motivated by greed. Tensions rise as the trial becomes a media sensation, revealing deeper family secrets and the emotional toll on everyone involved. And one thing about this is there were two parts, because we're going to get to the fact that this was a mistrial that might have been in episode 8. And before the mistrial, like, they were just celebrities and everyone was like, they need to be freed and get this. And then the verdict comes around. Okay, the verdict comes around, and this was in episode 8, you know, earthquakes keep hitting the city, and the trial faces disruptions because of that, and this causes chaos in both the courtroom and the brothers' personal lives. The natural disaster becomes a metaphor for the upheaval in their case as a new shocking testimony emerges. The episode weaves the tension of the trial with the literal shaking of the earth, emphasizing the instability and unpredictability of both the legal battle and the brothers' futures. And that's when you kind of realize that the brothers are going to jail and they might actually both be psychopaths, which was just a crazy, crazy reveal. Episode 9 comes around. It's called Hang Men. The trial reaches its climax as both sides deliver their final arguments, and the prosecutors just do a way better job than the defense. The tension in the courtroom is palpable. As the jury deliberates the brothers' fate, they do decide that they should not go to the death chamber, they decide they should go to prison for life. Outside the courtroom, the media frenzy intensifies. The brothers grapple with the looming possibility of a death sentence. The episode explores the emotional and psychological toll on Lyle and Eric, as well as the impact on the remaining family members as the trial nears its conclusion. And one thing you see in those final few episodes is the parents' point of view of how, you know, they were harsh on their kids, but the kids were very rude to them, how they talked to them. And then you had testimonies from the gardener, the tennis training coach, and you hear just how awful the boys talk to their parents. And, you know, you just get this different perspective of things, and we may never really know what happened. It's just pretty crazy. The viewership for this entire show, I mean, the season debuted at the number one spot on Netflix, gaining 12.3 million views within just 4 hours of its release. 4 hours of its release. On its second week, you're at 19.5 million views, and that's per Netflix account, and it received 13.1 million views on its third week, 8.7 million in its fourth, and I mean, you're getting up towards 100 million different accounts watching this show. Critical response, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, kind of mixed on it. I don't really like Rotten Tomatoes in the first place, but just to give you a little perspective, they gave it a 45%. It's way better than that, but just how they dive into the brothers and just how they view it, it was just such a mind mess. And as it ends really chilling, because you find out that the brothers are not going to the same prison. They're going separate ways, kind of symbolizing how they're both going on their own paths. And the episode ends because there was this boat trip that had been referenced over and over and over about how the family was going out shark fishing on a boat, and how the brothers tell them how it actually happened is just completely different. And the brothers thought, from their perspective, that their parents were going to kill them out there. But as the episode ends, you kind of see the parents kind of being like, yeah, you know what, we're making this work. Because Jose Menendez, terrible father, Kitty Menendez, terrible mother, terrible husband and wife to each other. And you kind of see them kind of reconsolidating. And as you look to the brothers to end the series, you kind of see Lyle going, we're going to do it tonight, right? We're going to do it. And Eric goes, yes, we're going to do it. So you never really know what happens. But that is my official review of Monsters, Lyle and Eric Menendez story. A little coverage of it. And the music was phenomenal in this eerie tense. Really gets you going. And, you know, this every episode kind of leaves you wanting a little bit more, which is what I look for in a show. I can't give it a 9 out of 10 just because I can. I was throwing out 10 out of 10s last episode. I was getting a little carried away. But this really is good. I encourage you all to watch it. It is chilling. It's chilling. I would never kill my parents. I love my parents. But I tell you what else I love, and that is pop culture. Reading new pop culture news and talking about all the different things. Number one, of course, every episode, if you don't know, we go over the top 10 new things in pop culture, courtesy of Discussing Film on Twitter. Christopher Nolan's next movie will not be a sci-fi, but some speculate that it may be going in the espionage genre. Ooh, I kind of like that little spy thriller, little treachery, little bit of this, little bit of that. Christopher Nolan has a very distinct style. He likes to play with time. He really likes to do with that, likes to really do good callbacks to his films. He's a millionaire, and honestly, he has earned his millions. He does a good job. Number two, some crazy information dropping today. Liam Payne has sadly passed away at the age of 31 as he fell off a balcony in Spain, apparently. That is very suspicious, if you ask me. I don't know what Liam Payne knew. I don't know if he was maybe just drunk, if he was suicidal or something. But whenever they're falling off balconies, dying to drug overdoses, you start to get the sneaking suspicion. Maybe they're going to spill some tea, and they had to get the axe. I don't know. Rest in peace, Liam Payne. You were a great singer, but I don't know. There's something fishy with this. I've been really meaning to do a full conspiracy theory episode. We may have to dive into that. Number three, David Corusett has been cast in Mr. Irrelevant. The film follows John Tuggle, who was given the title of Mr. Irrelevant after being the last pick of the last round of the 1983 NFL draft. David Corusett, I believe he's playing the next Superman whenever that movie comes out. But John Tuggle, sounds like this is just a 40-year-ago Brock Purdy. Okay, how about we make a movie about Brock Purdy? He's made it to the Super Bowl. I don't even know who this John Tuggle guy is. No idea when that comes out. That came from a Deadline. Number four, the first trailer for the Creep TV series has been released, releasing November 15th on Shudder. If no one knows what Creep is, it is the weirdest movie. Okay, the weirdest movie ever. I remember my buddy Kyle showed this to me and said it was a actually our buddy Hayden showed me and my buddy Kyle this movie, and it was supposed to be the scariest movie ever. And it's like shot through a camera. It's about this like photographer or whatever who goes to film this dying man, but he has this like wolf mask he puts on that he ends up killing him. It's just really just weird. And now they're making a TV series out of it. So you're gonna get some more creep. You're gonna see this murder or whatever he is with a bunch of tapes of stuff. It's just a very weird film, let me tell you that. But it's interesting. I won't lie, it is pretty interesting. Number four, Mason Dye has been cast as Bombsight in the final season of The Boys Season 5. Mason Dye is the guy from Stranger Things where he goes, "Hey, what you looking at, freak?" when he's talking to Eddie. He's kind of like the jock high school basketball player. I like him. I like that casting. He kind of strikes me as a villain. I don't know who Bombsight is. I don't know if he's one of... He has to be one of Homelander's cronies. He just would play too good of a villain. But yeah, exciting to see the final season of The Boys. Should be exciting. And Mason Dye, good acting choice. Bombsight. I love the names of the superheroes, or what you want to call them, soups, if you will, in The Boys. Very, very good names. Number six, the FTC has finalized the new click-to-cancel rule. All subscriptions / membership services like Netflix, Hulu, and such will be required to offer one click to cancel with the new rule. The rule will go into effect in 180 days after being published. I love that. How many of us have to deal with pesky cancellations? I know I do. Thank you, FTC, finally doing something good for the people. It's about damn time. About damn time. Number seven, first behind-the-scenes look at the final Conjuring movie hits theaters on September 5th, 2025. The Conjuring, so spooky. The other ones, they creep me out so much. But this behind-the-scenes just kind of shows the Conjuring, you know, with the classic directors. What do you even call that? You know when they clack the thing and they go, scene or cut, and they clap the thing? I don't even know what it is. But last it says, The Conjuring, Last Rites, I believe, and they still are filming. Interesting stuff. I'll be curious to watch it. Number eight, Tom Hardy, when asked if Spider-Man will appear in Venom The Last Dance, he said, "There's always possibilities. I can't say anything because this is the last movie." I'm sure Tom Hardy doesn't know. Tom Hardy does not know the lore of anything, but I won't lie. Tom Hardy, you are a good actor. And this Venom The Last Dance movie actually looks pretty good. I think the first two are kind of average movies, but, you know, it's a dumb superhero movie. We'll go watch it. Two more if I could get some good ones. I'm trying to find a good one. There's always so many. A lot of stuff with Wallace and Gromit. They're making a new movie. I know a lot of people are talking about that. Very interesting. Wallace and Gromit, they're coming out with a new movie releasing January 3rd on Netflix. It's called Wallace and Gromit, Vengeance Most Foul. And I will say that bunny movie with Wallace and Gromit haunted me as a kid. I used to be terrified watching that. Very good movie there. And number 10, we'll say this. Smile 2 is a sequel that manages to be superior to the original in every way and easily becomes one of the best horror movies of 2024. Smile has to do with a demon, and whenever the demon infects you, you smile. You just can't stop smiling. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. I don't know. That's your new pop culture rundown. A lot of interesting things. I'll give you that. But I will not be seeing Smile or the Wallace and Gromit movie, but I'm sure there's other movies I will have to go and watch. So let's get right on into our NFL Week 7 quick picks. Get it over with. Let you all know who I'm picking. I'm gonna come back, guys. Okay, I'm going to be so back this week. I am yet to win any weeks in Pick'em. Okay, I'm yet to make it on the Wall of Fame at school. Our campus has a Wall of Fame in our like athletic area for intramurals, and I get a shirt if I win the weekly Pick'em. And I've been so off, I've been so bad, but this is where we come back. This is where we rally. This is where we go, I believe. What is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. There are 15 games this week, and we are about to go perfect. All right, you can bet your biscuits on that. So kicking things off, we got a little Thursday night football as the Broncos visit the Saints. Okay, so the Broncos visiting the Saints. Broncos are currently 3-3. Coming off a loss. On the road, they are 2-1, which is pretty promising. The Saints, they are third in the AFC South, 2-4 on a 4-game losing streak, and are 1-2 at home. Now, what I've seen from the Broncos is Bo Nix has actually been coming out as the best player on this Broncos team. The Saints, you never know what you're going to get with them. It's kind of a mixture of things. But as I look at the past Thursday night football, past Thursday night football matchups, you can actually start to formulate a pattern. Okay, so last week, away team, the 49ers won. Week before that, home team, the Falcons won. Week four, away team, the Cowboys won. Week three, Patriots lose to the Jets. Jets were home. Okay, week two, on the road, Bills win. Week number one, at home, Chiefs win. There is a pattern, and the pattern lies within the Saints. And even if the pattern wasn't true, I would still probably ride with the Saints. I do think they're better than the Broncos. Plus, they've been playing some really tough teams, okay? Saints could use a bit of a break. I think this is where they catch their break, and they get a victory. We are going to predict the Saints to win. Do I really have a reason other than that? Not really, but the pattern is there. We've identified it. We've identified it, all right? We're going to ride with it. Saints over Broncos, my official prediction. After that, we head to Sunday, and we have one last game in London, and it's the Jaguars. Okay, the Jaguars take on the Patriots. And funny enough, this matchup is super hilarious because both teams are 1-5. Both teams are 1-5. Patriots 1-5, only 83 points for. 0-3 at home, 1-2 on the road on a 5-game losing streak. As for the Jaguars, one game losing streak, 0-4 on the road, also 1-5. They have gotten 113 points for, but it's time. Okay, it's time. The Jaguars are not going 0-2 in London. Okay, the Bears game, we thought they would get it. They didn't, but they are so back. They are so back. The Jaguars are taking this one. Tank Bigsby's going off. Brian Thomas Jr.'s going off. Evan Ingram's going off. T-Law's going off. The Jaguars are going to be so back. This is technically a road game for both, but the Patriots, they're flying back from the United States. They're flying from the United States to London, okay? The Jags have been there. They're accustomed to the culture. They've been immersing themselves in the United Kingdom, and this is where they get the victory. Jaguars, second win of the season. It's about time. And Drake May looked good, but this Jaguars team is finding their footing, and I think Drake May is going to be in for a rude awakening when he reaches London. After that, we head into Sunday, we head to noon, and we kick things off with the Seahawks and the Falcons. Seahawks visiting the Falcons, Battle of the Birds. Battle of the Birds in the NFC. Seahawks are 3-3, second in the NFC West on a 3-game losing streak. They are 1-1 on the road. As for the Falcons, 4-2, 3-game win streak. They are 2-2 at home and do have a plus 14 point differential. Good stuff for them. Look, as I've been watching both of these teams play, you know, Falcons are on a heater. Seahawks are on kind of a curve. You just have to look at who they've been playing. 49ers have lost. The Seahawks have lost to the 49ers, Giants, and Lions. I'll give them the 49ers and Lions. Okay, I will let those games slide. As for the Falcons, who have they been getting these wins over? Okay, the Saints in an absolute barn burner, that's one. Buccaneers in a barn burner, that's another one. Then you also have the Panthers. So they made a little run in their division. The Falcons cleared out their division. They just beat all their divisional opponents 3 straight weeks. Now you're taking on someone outside of your division, a Seahawks team, which really is in need of a win. You know, 1-1 on the road isn't too bad, but do the Falcons go on a win streak, or do the Seahawks pull off a little upset in Atlanta? I don't know. This team appears to be healthy from the Seahawks. I got Jaxon Smith-Njigba. I got Kenneth Walker. I don't want to say I'm a Falcons hater here, but we got to go for some upsets. So we are going to go with the Seahawks beating the Falcons. I know it might be a controversial pick, but we got to do it. We got to go for the controversial picks to get it done. People aren't going to see this one coming. This is not going to be the game they have circled going, oh, this is going to be upset. People are going to see Falcons on a win streak, Seahawks on a losing streak, and write them off. No, the Falcons are on a 3-game win streak over all divisional opponents. They're finally going to play someone from outside of their division, and they're going to strike their third loss of the season. Promise you that. After that, the Titans visit the Bills. Do I even need to elaborate? I got Bills all day. This would be an upset, let me tell you. Titans are 1-4, 96 points on the year. 1-1 on the road there. Their one win did come on the road. But I mean, goodness me, the Bills, 4-2, 1-game win streak, just got Amari Cooper. Been dying to see him play with a good quarterback. This is Bills all day. This is Bills. After watching what Josh Allen did on Monday Night Football against the Jets, I'm very confident he can lead this team. James Cook wasn't even healthy, and Ray Davis was chopping up that Jets defense, which is amazing. So 4-2 Bills, top of the AFC East. They get a win here. Titans are just abysmal. After that, Bengals visit the Browns in a little AFC North matchup. Browns are 1-5, one of the worst teams in the entire league. Bengals 2-4, probably the best 2-4 team. Okay, 2-4 on the year, have a +5 point differential, 157 to 152. That should tell you all you need to know about how good they are. And Joe Burrow, T. Higgins, Jamar Chase, they've been balling. Chase Brown, even the running back, Zach Moss. This team is well-rounded. I just think they had an early year slump. Okay, kind of like the Vikings last year. The Bengals are the Vikings of last year. How do you like that? Browns just lost to Amari Cooper. Deshaun Watson absolutely sucks. They don't have Nick Chubb. Jerry Jeudy's probably wide receiver one. I'm sorry. There's no hope for the Browns. There is no hope for the Browns. And if the Bengals do lose to the Browns here, I would probably not be a Bengals fan anymore. But Bengals on the road, taking this one, these divisional matchups, it never matters if you're home or away. Divisional games are always kind of in the same territory. Following that, we head to one of the best games of the week as the Texans visit the Packers. And as a D1 Packers hater, I got to give them credit. They have been playing pretty good. They are 4-2 in our bottom of the NFC North. NFC North, best division in football. It's a shame the Lions and Vikings have to play because that means one of us is going to lose. But it happens. It has to happen twice every single year. Packers, 4-2 on a little two-game win streak. They are 2-1 at home. Okay, so that's pretty good. Texans, 5-1. I was going to say 5-1. Three-game win streak. They are 3-0 at home, 2-1 on the road. They've been looking phenomenal. The only team to beat the Texans so far this year, the Minnesota Vikings. And I just have a sneaking suspicion about this one, that the Texans are going to have a kryptonite for their season. I truly believe the Texans have a very, I don't really want to say easy schedule. Easy doesn't feel like the correct term, but when I look at their schedule, when I look at the matchups that they'll be having, because, you know, it's the AFC South and the NFC North, this is the year we all match up. You know, the Texans are going to play the Colts, the Jets, those are wins. They're going to play the Cowboys, the Jaguars, of course, the Dolphins, the Chiefs maybe. But, you know, they're playing the Lions. Actually, they already beat the Bears, didn't they? Oh, never mind. My strategy is kind of out the window. I just realized that they beat the Bears. Actually, the Packers lose at home. Who have the Packers lost at home to? Actually, what am I doing? I'm not a Packers fan. I am a Houston Texans fan this week. We're going Texans over Packers. I was trying to find some pattern. This is always happens. I always reach, look for patterns. We're going Texans over Packers. Look, even without Nico Collins, Stephon Diggs, Tank Dell are absolute murderers, and Joe Mixon will shred the Packers run game. Promise you that. So that's what we'll ride with. AFC matchup here. We're heading on down to the AFC East. Dolphins will be taking on the AFC South Colts. Colts are 3-3. Second in the AFC South, coming off of a victory. Dolphins are also coming off a win. Also coming off a bye. They're 2-3. 60 points for. They have the worst offense in the league. There's just little hope for that Dolphins team. As for the Colts, Joe Flacco is an absolute dime, an absolute beauty. Give me Colts all day. Give me Colts all day over the damn Dolphins. I mean, I don't even need to sugarcoat it, do I? Colts are just a phenomenal team all around. Joshua Downs, Michael Pittman. With Jonathan Taylor out, Trey Goodman and, what was it, Goodman and Sermon. They carry the backfield. They do pretty decently. I'm okay with this Colts team. I really am. And Flacco, reliable as always. Dolphins, you know, Tua is being rushed back apparently, and Huntley just can't win games confidently. Tyreek needs a good quarterback. It ain't them. Dolphins going to fall to 2-4. Shockingly, Colts, I predict, will move to 4-3. And then we get into what could be the best game of the weekend, but I also have a sneaking suspicion it might go a different way. So Lions and Vikings, as we all know, I pick the Vikings every week. Okay, I pick the Vikings every week. You have to pick your team to win every single week. You truly have to believe it. And I believe the Vikings can beat the Packers. Now, there's just a couple factors that I worry about. First off, we're not going to have Aaron Jones, okay, which means you're going to have Ty Chandler and the newly acquired, reacquired, I should say, Cam Akers in the backfield. So, backfield advantage goes to the Lions. I mean, David Montgomery and Jahmyr Gibbs solo, Cam Akers and Ty Chandler. Aaron Jones being out definitely hurts us. Now, wide receiver-wise, you know, the Lions have just have so much momentum, all right? Three-game win streak. They will be at home, okay? Actually, they're going to be on the road. They're visiting the Vikings, and they're 2-0 on the road. That scares me. Vikings are 3-0 at home. We're undefeated, so there's a benefit. But these are clashing our defense, number one defense. We got to get that going for us. But the fact that Sam Laporta, that Amon-Ra St. Brown haven't even been that involved in the offense. And you got Jameson Williams out there cooking us. You got Tim Patrick out there cooking us. You got these guys you wouldn't expect on this Lions offense to be really making plays. It worries me when we then have to lock up the Amon-Ra St. Browns and the Sam Laportas, and we struggle with that. I will say the Vikings, you know, Justin Jefferson, he's going to have a good day. Jordan Addison, he's going to have a good day. I'm confident in what we can get done, but I am a little worried. You know, everyone's going to be picking the Lions for this one, but we ride with the Vikings. Our momentum was kind of starting to dip, okay? Our momentum was starting to dip, so I think a bye week was actually pretty good, but I do hope we don't go out and get blown out because the Lions are coming in with a huge, huge momentum boost after winning 47-9 over the Cowboys. Vikings over the Lions, I will ride with my Vikings to death. But the Lions, I do worry about them. And with that, we get into our final noon game of the day. The Eagles take on the Giants. And this one is much more interesting than you would think, just because it's a divisional matchup. You know, Eagles are 3-2, coming off a win. Giants 2-4, bottom of the AFC East. They're coming off a loss. And it'd be very easy to pick the Eagles. I definitely think it'd be very easy to pick them. But, I mean, they have a minus point differential. They haven't looked, they should have, this team with all the talent they have, Jalen Hurts, A.J. Brown, Saquon Barkley, Devontae Smith, Dallas Goedert, they should be so well-rounded. It's like they just don't have a connection, all right? And this Giants team is just almost laughably atrocious, It wouldn't surprise me if they squeak out a win. It honestly really wouldn't. Giants, they only have 2 wins on the whole year, one of those wins over the Browns, another one over the Seahawks. Which, I don't know if hindsight, those are the best wins, but we'll give it to them. Blake Nabers might be out again. Darius Slayton and Vandell Robinson can pick up the slack. But when I look at the star power of these teams, the Eagles should technically win. We're going to ride with them. All right, we're going to ride with the Eagles because I do need to pick some away teams to win this week. But I just don't know, guys. I really don't know. Eagles over the Giants with not much confidence. I just kind of get the sneaking suspicion you're going to see a Giants upset. Actually, do we have a plus or minus on that? Do we have any odds for that? The Giants are plus 140. Yeah, Eagles are minus 165. Those are actually pretty close odds. I'm not surprised by that in the slightest. So there's that. After that, we get into our 3 o'clock games. The Raiders visit the Rams. And this Raiders team, I would be in panic mode. I would be in panic mode if I was this Raiders team. They are just falling apart left and right. It's atrocious. The only good part of this team is Brock Bowers now. All right, Devontae Adams gone to New York, off on a jet somewhere, hanging out with Aaron Rodgers, and this Raiders team has just left to pick up the pieces. Aiden O'Connell, Alexander Mattison, Jacoby Myers is now your wide receiver one. It's not pretty. Raiders 2-4, 2-game losing streak, bottom of the AFC West. There's just little hope for them. Now, the one hope they do have, okay, is that they are 1-2 on the road, so we know that they can win on the road this year, even if it hasn't been the best. And the Rams are 1-4. The Rams are 1-4. Their only win has been at home. They're on a 2-game losing streak. But the killer is they're probably getting Cooper Kupp back, which is what I think is going to be just the knife in the heart. Rams going to pick up their second win of the season with my prediction. We got to ride with them. Rams all day. Kyren Williams going to chop up that Raiders defensive line. After that matchup, Panthers visit the Commanders, and this should be the easiest prediction you hear. You are statistically better to predict against the Panthers than you are for them, okay? The Commanders over the Panthers in the first place, just because statistically, the Panthers are not going to win a lot of games. Not going to win a lot of games at all. They have one win. They have one win. The Panthers have been given one win all year, all right? And you want to know who that win was freaking over? All right, you want to know the one win they squeaked out was the Raiders. That should tell you all you need to know. And that was Andy Dalton's first game. You've already adjusted and realized this can't be a long-term fix. Commanders, all right, Jaden Daniels was just given a reality check, taking on Lamar Jackson and the Ravens, and he's going to be coming out, your MVP front runner, your Rookie of the Year runner, one of the best quarterbacks in the game, whatever you want to call him, he's coming for vengeance. 178 points so far on the season. This is tied for the second best offense in the NFC, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm double checking this, they are actually tied for the best offense. Commanders have the best tied for the best offense, oddly enough, with none other than the Buccaneers, oddly enough. Wow, how about that? Fun fact, I just learned that right now. I'm actually a little shocked by that. But Commanders, they're coming out for ferocity. They're coming out for anger, for pain. They're just coming to bring the hurt. Panthers, they got Chuba Hubbard. That's about all they got. I think they might deal Deontay Johnson to the Chiefs or something. And speaking of which, the Chiefs and the 49ers do battle at 3:25. There is no reason that this matchup should not be taking place on Sunday Night Football. How is this not Sunday Night Football? The Chiefs and 49ers, how is our Super Bowl rematch a 3:25 game? That's just ridiculous to me. Chiefs 5-0 coming off the bye, taking on the 49ers. 49ers are 2-1 at home, coming off a win last week. Good for them. Top of the NFC West. They do hold the tiebreaker over the Seahawks. And their opponents, the reigning Super Bowl champs, the two-time Super Bowl champs, the Chiefs, 5-0, 2-0 on the road. They're them and the Vikings, only undefeated teams. I'm thinking that either both the Vikings and the Chiefs win or both the Vikings and the Chiefs lose. So I'm going to go with the Chiefs over the 49ers. I would rather pick the Chiefs and get it right because my reward would be that the 49ers win. And that's what I would be rooting for. But some about this Chiefs team, man, some about them. And just I get the feeling they're going to be making a trade sooner or later to get a new wide receiver. They're taking too many hits. And I just think they've played the 49ers enough where the 49ers might be able to squeak one out. But more often than not, the Chiefs are going to get the victory. So Chiefs over the 49ers is my prediction. But what we do hope is that the Chiefs lose. We always root for a Chiefs loss, but we will always pick them because statistically, they'll usually win. With that, we get into our Sunday Night Football matchup as the Jets take on the Steelers. Steelers 4-2 to start out the year, and funny enough, they are 1-1 at home. They've done better on the road. They didn't come up to get a big win. Got a big win last week over the Raiders. As for the Jets, 3-game losing streak, 2-4, but this is the turn of the century, okay? They now got Davante Adams. Their hopes are going to be restated, if you will, or will they? Or will they? And I don't know. I don't know. Because a part of me, you know, what Justin Fields has been doing has been phenomenal with this Steelers team. But it has been on the ground game. Him and Najee Harris. It's the ground game. And their defense. Steelers have number 6 defense, number 5 defense in the NFL. Okay? Jets also have a top 10 defense. Offense isn't really top 10. Aaron Rodgers has been having a lot of turnovers. And I just think I saw what the Bills did to them. Okay? The Bills don't have the greatest defense in the league. The Steelers do. Okay, the Steelers do, and as much as I think Davante Adams may be back, I think you're going to have a clashing of Garrett Wilson, Alan Lazard, Davante Adams, even maybe Mike Williams, okay, might even be a clashing, with Breece Hall, too, of, you know, Devontae's just coming in, you know, it's Aaron Rodgers pulling a little Tom Brady, pulling a little LeBron James, calling the shots, bringing in all his buddies, and it rarely works. Sometimes it works the first year, but we're oddly in year two. We're 2-4 to start the year. I'm going to go with the Steelers, who have that team camaraderie, who can trust each other, and when it comes down to defenses, I'm taking the Steelers over the Jets. With that, we get into Monday Night Football, and we have two games for some reason. The first one, starting at 7:15, Ravens visiting the Buccaneers. How about a great matchup right there? How about a banger matchup? Ravens 4-2, best team in the AFC North, 4-game win streak. They are 2-1 on the road, impressively enough. They've been doing good ever since they dropped their first two. Derrick Henry, best running back in the league. Lamar Jackson, the best quarterback currently. Defense has been not the best, pretty average if you ask me. But I mean, Isaiah Likely, Mark Andrews, probably the best tight end duo in the entire league if you really think about it. Zay Flowers, one of the best wide receivers in the game. He's been climbing the fantasy scoreboard. And don't you forget about Rashad Bateman, Nelson Agholor. You got killers on that team. Their opponent, though, the Buccaneers, like I said earlier, the best offense in the league. This team is scary good. Baker with the Bucks, but Baker Bucks is just, he's money. He's my Chris Godwin, best wide receiver in the league. And you forget about Mike Evans, all right? That's a nasty duo right there. Running back situation is always tricky. You got Rashad White, you got Sean Trent now, you got Bucky Irving. I don't really know what's going on there, but Bucks, so far they've gone 2-1 at home and on the road. These two teams have been very similar. It's going to be really tough to pick a winner. I know that the Ravens aren't going to go undefeated this year, but when I just look at the Bucs team, okay, they got 51-27 blowout. It was over the Saints. They choked the lead against the Falcons. They were able to blow out a kind of a hurt Eagles team without A.J. Brown or Devontae Smith. A fully functional Buccaneers team lost to the Broncos. Okay, so I'm going to be riding with the Ravens here. They're tested and proven. They're going to be one of the hitters in the AFC North this year, and even the NFL in general. Ravens over the Bucs. because I also do have Zay Flowers, and I really want Zay Flowers. They do super good. With that, we get into our final game for week number 7, as the Chargers will be visiting the Cardinals. Very interesting matchup here. Chargers picked up a big win over the Broncos. They're now 2-1 on the road, 1-1 at home, 3-2 on the year. So we do know they're good on the road, but I will say they were up 23 rip and gave up 16 in the last quarter. So they kind of did fade at the end. They don't really have much star power. It's really been their defense, which has shined bright. The run game, they love to attack the run game. J.K. Dobbins, an absolute killer out there. They're even getting the rookie Vidal involved, which I really do love to see. As for the Cardinals, 2-4, third in the NFC West, coming off a loss, minus 30-point differential. This Cardinals team is just kind of awkward. Kind of awkward, if you ask me. Because, you know, here you have Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray coming off of an injured 2023 season. He's back. All right, he's back, and he just doesn't have his mojo like he used to. And, like, sure, Marvin Harrison Jr. is an amazing wide receiver. He's going to have a great career, similar to his dad's. But I just don't know if it's with Kyler Murray. I just really don't. It just, you know, Greg Dortch, I'm seeing, is catching more touchdowns than Marvin Harrison Jr. And Marvin Harrison Jr., you know, it's kind of like a week on, week off, week on, week off. Same with James Conner. James Conner is just kind of reaching that point where, you know, it might be time to find a new running back if you're the Cardinals. It's kind of sad to see, but on the other hand, I don't know if the Chargers are going to be a team to go into a Monday Night Football and get the win. Do I have both road teams winning on Monday Night Football? I don't really know. As I look at my weekly predictions, you know, what do we say? We have 15 games. I've currently given 5 road teams the victory, and every single week it's kind of a flip-flop of home teams winning, away teams winning. Let me actually look at last week's games just to kind of get a perspective. Last week, guys, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, holy cow, 7, 8, oh my gosh, 9, 10. We had 10 of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 10 of the 14 games road teams won. So, okay, screw me, I'm picking too many home teams, clearly. You know what, screw this, we're picking the Chargers to beat the Cardinals on Monday Night Football. Why not? Why not? Road teams apparently are the juice of the league. Chargers it is. Chargers it is. How many points will be scored in that game? Let's do Chargers put up 26. Cardinals get 20, so 46. How about that? Imagine if I get that correct. Now that would be super impressive. That's your NFL quick picks for week 7, which isn't really that quick since it took me like 23 minutes, but you know what? It happens. It happens. I like to give my input on things. I really do. Let me know what you guys are picking. And also fantasy football. I would share more, but I'm in 5 freaking leagues. I'm not going over all my teams. But I tell you what we are going over, guys. And that is our UFC Vegas 99 official predictions. I'm so excited. I love the UFC. Only 11 matchups, too. So this won't take freaking hours of my day to go over. We did conjure up some notes. We are going to drop our predictions. It's going to be tricky. But for the main event, I do actually have a fighter I want to win. So you'll have to stick around to see who I predict and who I choose as my victor. Without a doubt, let's get right into it. Before we get into it, I do just want to say that we went 10-2 on predictions last week. We were on absolute fire. I do want to say that. So we're red hot right now, guys. We are 252 correct picks on the year, 161 incorrect. We're up all time. I really should bet. Next year, 2025, we're getting it. We're placing bets on every single UFC fight money line. Might as well. We could run parlays. But I feel like if I were to place like $1 on every fight, or even $2, I would be up all time, right? Wouldn't I be? I don't really know. We'll have to see. But we kick things off for UFC Vegas 99, the 99th UFC Vegas event. Of course, main evented by Michelle Pereira and Anthony Hernandez in the men's middleweight division. But we're starting out in the men's heavyweight division. I love me some heavyweights as Austin Lane takes on Robles, the big boy, Despanje. Austin 12-5 with 1 no contest. Robles 5-1, 6'7" to 6'6". These are some tall mofos. Robles with the height advantage. And he also has 4 inches in reach with the biggest reach on the UFC roster, 84 inches to Austin Lane's 80. Both men stand in the orthodox fighting position. Let's start out with Robles, guys. He's the minus 385 favorite. Austin Lane at plus 295. If you're a betting man, Robles, 36 years old from Cuba. All five of his wins have come by knockout in round number one, and he has a Taekwondo background. He had a great debut in March with an 18-second performance of the night knockout of Josh Parshan. Actually kicked him out of the UFC with that knockout, but unfortunately was humbled in May when he took on Waldo Cortez Acosta on short notice, and he got out-grappled for three straight rounds, taken down three or four times for 9 minutes, 49 seconds of control time. So we know his weakness. We know that Robelis, if you can just survive the onslaught and land a takedown, that's that. And that's all Waldo did. He literally just, you know, pressed him right away, covered his head, took him down. That was the name of the game. So if Robelis can get around that, he'll be successful. The Taekwondo background is kind of what leads to him getting taken down. You know, he's much more of a striker. And we'll have to see how he handles that as he takes on Austin Lane. Austin Lane, 36 years old, from Florida. Out of his 12 wins, 11 knockouts and one sub means he has a 100% finish rate. On the other end, all five of his losses he has been knocked out in. So this man has never gone the distance. In fact, he rarely leaves round one. Just absolutely crazy. You know, lost on Dana White's Contender Series back in 2018, got finished in 57 seconds, but came back in 2022 and got a round one knockout of Richard Jacoby. Then debut in the UFC, takes on Justin Taffa. Eye poke 30 seconds in. After that, takes on Justin Taffa, UFC 293, knocked out in just over a minute. Came back in April of this year, was looking good against Hinata Dinez in round one, and then Hinata Dinez knocked him out in round number two. So Austin Lane not coming in with much momentum. This one should not surprise anyone who watches this. Robelis Desponje by round one knockout. It's just, it's so free. It feels so free, and I mean, we didn't do too bad on predicting rounds and finish types last episode, and even historically, but with this one, you know, Austin Lane's chin just seems to be failing him just over and over and over again, and here we have an opportunity for Robelis to get even better knockout. So, Robelis over Austin Lane. I'm sorry, Austin. I'm sorry, but I am going to be picking Robelis. I don't even hate Austin Lane. It's just my opinion that I got Robelis winning. After that, we head to the little women's division action in the women's strawweight division as Melissa Supermelly Martinez takes on Elise Ardeline. Melissa is 7-1, Elise is 9-6. Ooh, 5'3 to 5'2 gives Elise 1 inch in height. 4 inches in reach actually go to Melissa, though. 66 to 62. Southpaw with the left for Melissa. Orthodox with the right for Elise Ardeline. Elise Ardeline, I think I'm saying that correctly. We'll start with her, plus 130 underdog. Melissa Martinez, the minus 155 favorite. Elise, 32 years old from Romania, but now lives in England. Of her 9 wins, 4 KOs and 4 submissions. Out of her 6 losses, she's been submitted twice. And she was actually supposed to take on Rayane Dos Santos, but Rayane pulled out of their matchup. Elise made her UFC debut in July, taking on Shauna Bannon, where she lost by split decision. Close fight, though. She did get outstruck. You know, her grappling looked strong in round 1 and 2, but she just faded. In round number 3, that was just the name of the game. Elise, 9-6, not the most impressive UFC record, but kind of expected with someone of her caliber. You know, 8 of 9 career victories by finish, though, is pretty promising. Her opponent, Melissa Martinez, is not going to make it easy for her. Minus 155 favorite, 27 years old from Mexico. Of her 7 wins, she has 5 knockouts. And fun fact, she actually had one canceled fight last year in 2023 against Yasmin Lucindo. Last time she actually fought was in 2022, where she lost to Elise Reed. And if anyone knows who Elise Reed is, she is most recently lost to Lupi Godinez. And she's not been the most exciting fighter. We're actually going to be talking about her in just a second. And the fact that Elise was able to knock down Melissa Martinez kind of tells me all I need to know about this one. It's the women fights here on the prelims where the underdogs thrive. We are going to go with Elise Ardeline simply because this is an even matchup. Neither woman really brings any appeal to the fight whatsoever. And that sounds so mean. You know, that sounds really mean. And I actually kind of feel bad that I'm phrasing it like that. But I mean, I'm going to go with the underdog. Why not? You know, it's not going to hurt him, especially with these caliber split decision, close fight. I think Elise will bounce back in this one. Let's stick with the women's strawweight division here for a second. I love that they're having all three women's fights on the card, like just back to back to back. The women's strawweight division, the woman we just mentioned, Elise Reed, she takes on Jessica Penne. Jessica Penne, plus 130, underdog. Elise Reed, the favorite, minus 155. 5'5" to 5'3". Give Jessica 2 inches in height. She also has 4 inches of reach, 67 inches to 63. Jessica Penne, ladies and gentlemen, 41 years old from California, still going strong in the UFC. 14-8 professional MMA record. Of those 14 wins, 2 KOs and 8 subs. Now, of her 8 losses, she has been finished 4 times, and recently she is on a 2-fight losing streak. Been with the UFC since 2012. My goodness. Fought Michelle Warson Gomez, actually fought Joanna Jędrzejczyk for the Women's Strawweight Championship back in 2015. Did get knocked out in round 3, but still cool enough. She's fought Jessica Andrade, Lupi Godinez. Last win was over Karolina Kowalski in April of 2021. So been a while. Last time she fought, March of 2023. So she's pushing John Jones bad, not fighting that often. I will say that'll hurt you, but her last loss was to Tabitha Ritchie, who is currently the number 10 woman strawweight. So I wouldn't necessarily hold that too much against her. Penne, she is old though. She's pushing past 40. She is past 40. And she takes on Elise Reed. And Elise Reed, 31 years old from New Jersey, out of her 7 wins, has 2 knockouts. Now, out of all of her 4 losses, she's been finished. Okay, and she's currently on a little pattern here of win, loss, win, loss, win, loss. 2021 debuts, knocked out in round 1. Then gets a split decision win. Comes back, round 3 TKO, loses, then beats Melissa Martinez, like we mentioned. Then gets submitted by Lumen Lokbunmi. Then, last time she won, June of 2023, gets a win over Jen Yu Frey. Then comes back against Lupi Godinez and gets brutally finished in round number 2. Literally ran through. And that was at UFC Noche 2023. She was obliterated in that one. Faced 6 submission attempts in a 2-round fight. Crazy enough. This one, kind of tough to read. We're following a little pattern here of, Elise Reed going win-loss, win-loss, win-loss. Penne hasn't fought in a long time. It's tough to know what will happen here. We're going to go with Elise Reed just because I'm not picking both women underdogs. I feel like they always kind of flip-flop. But it's just, I feel like this will be a close one. I feel like I could even see a split decision for Elise Reed. But so far, none of these women fights I see being finishes. Which brings me into our third women's fight, this time in the women's bantamweight division, as Jocelyn La Pantera Edwards takes on Tamires Tractor Vidal. What nicknames here? Jocelyn 13-6, Tamira 7-3. 5'8 to 5'6 gives Jocelyn 2 inches in height. She also has 2 inches in reach, 70-68. Both women stand in the orthodox fighting position. Jocelyn, the -215 favorite. Tamira is +165. Jocelyn, 29 years old, from Panama. Out of her 13 wins, she has 8 finishes, 5 KOs and 3 subs. Out of her 6 losses, she has been submitted once. She actually trains at King's MMA with Rafael Dos Anjos, Benil Dariush, Giga Chikadze. She trains with some real killers. Been with the UFC since 2021. She's gone 4-4 in the UFC, so this will probably be make or break for her. All of her fights, going to a decision, she's, never really done anything. You know, she's lost her last 2 fights just by being, actually, I don't even know. She was out-grappled in one, she was out-struck in the other. Jocelyn just really doesn't do much. So we'll have to see what she brings to the table. She's more of a striker, apparently, although she has grappled. I don't know what to make of Jocelyn, but Tamires Vidal, another nutcase. We don't know what we're going to go with here. The +165 underdog, 26 years old, from Brazil. Out of Tamires Vidal's 7 professional victories, she has 1 KO and 2 subs. Out of her 3 losses, she's been finished twice. Currently on a 2-fight losing streak, she won her UFC debut with a flying knee in 2022. And after that, split decision loss in 2023, and fought most recently in May, where she was knocked out in round 3 by Melissa Gatto. I don't know what we're going to get here, guys. I truly don't know what we're going to get. But Tamires Vidal just does not seem like UFC caliber talent. And Jocelyn strikes me as a decision machine. Because she is, we're going to go with La Pantera from Panama, Jocelyn Edwards. -215 favorite. We'll go with it. I don't expect much action here. We're really going from a heavyweight action to 3 straight women's fights. I hate to say it's kind of disappointing, but it is. Let's leave the women's bantamweight division. Let's go to the men's bantamweight division for a banger and electric matchup here as Brad Superman Katona takes on Gene Matsumoto. And Brad's not bringing it. Gene saw Matsumoto is bringing it. Brad Katona, 16-3. Gene Matsumoto, 15-0. Both men are 5'6". 4 inches in reach to Gene, 68-64. Orthodox stance for both of these young men, and I am pumped for this one. Brad, the +190 underdog, -245 favorite for Gene Matsumoto. Brad Katona, 32 years old, from Canada, but actually lives in Ireland, trains at SBG Ireland, same gym as Conor McGregor, fun fact. Out of his 16 wins, he has 1 KO and 3 subs. Never been finished in his three UFC losses. Three losses professionally in his career. Two-time Ultimate Fighter winner. Just never gets finishes. Never really does. You know, his record in the UFC is 4-3. Coming off a win in June, he did lose in January. He is just as average as it comes. I'm sorry, Brad. I really, really am. There's just no excitement to him. Really, he's a decision machine. All of his fights in the UFC have gone to a decision. Never even attempted a finish. Never landed a knockdown. Never gone for a submission attempt. Nothing. I don't even know what Brad does. Truly. Last fight, 68 significant strikes, 3 takedowns. So 11 minutes control time. So Brad's more of a grappler. But as for Jean Matsumoto, this is where the action comes in. 25 years old from Brazil. Of his 15 wins, 9 finishes. 3 by KO, 6 by sub. Won his UFC debut in April with a round 2 guillotine choke with a second left in round number 2. Look, you can't pay me to pick Brad Katona. Okay, it's Jean Matsumoto all day. And I'm thinking another submission. Okay, I'm going Jean Matsumoto by submission. Submission round 2 will say Brad's finally going to get caught. Brad's finally going to get finished. I swear, if he's not going to win the UFC championship. Okay, Jean Matsumoto could. Jean Matsumoto could be a UFC champion, not Brad Katona. Jean Matsumoto all day. I like this guy. He's action-packed. He's exciting. He's fun and feisty. So yeah, Jean over Brad. No offense, Brad. With that, we get into our first ranked competitors of the evening as the number 7th ranked men's flyweight Matthias Nicolau takes on the number 14th ranked Asu Almabayev. I absolutely love this. Zulfikar. Actually, I remember your nickname, Asu, because Zulfikar, I have no idea what it freaking means. But I guess we'll learn it here. Matthias plus 155, ranked number 7, minus 185 for the 14th ranked Asu Almabayev. Mathus 19-5-1, Asu 20-2. 5'6" to 5'4" gives Matthias 2 inches in height. He also has 1 inch reach, 66-65. Orthodox stance with that right arm for both of these men. Let's start with the number 7th ranked Matthias Nicolau, 31 years old from Brazil. Of his 19 wins, 10 finishes, split, 5 KOs, 5 subs. Out of his 5 losses, he's been knocked out in all 5. 3 of those coming in the UFC. Matthias, been with the UFC since 2015, you know, had a little stint from 2015 to 2018, went 3-1, came back in 2021, went on a little four-fight win streak in the UFC, wins over Manel Cape, Tim Elliott, David Dork, Matt Schnell, and then ran into Brandon Royval last year. And then earlier this year, ran into Alex Perez, and he was knocked out brutally in both of those. The Alex Perez one, super nasty knockout there. Matthias not coming in with much momentum. He is a grappler. Definitely a grappler. I mean, good takedown offense at times. We've seen him knock out Matt Schnell before, but as we could historically look, you know, the Manel Cape fight, the Tim Elliott fight, he's not the most exciting fighter, but we'll have to see if Asu Almabayev brings something out of him, because Asu Almabayev, the favorite, 30 years old, from Kazakhstan, 20-2 on a 16 fight win streak. Are you freaking kidding me? This dude has not lost since 2017. Has not lost since 2017, okay? 3 KOs, 9 subs, 12 of his 20 wins by finish. He has 1 of his 2 losses by submission. 3-0 in the UFC. Debuted in August of 2023. Rear naked chokehold. Then so far has won 2 decisions over CJ Vergara and Jose Johnson. Outgrappled them both, combined 15 takedowns. Look, I don't know what more you want. We're going to Asu Almabayev. I don't know if it's going to be a submission, if it's going to be a decision, but Asu Almabayev is going to take Matthias Nicolau to school. Unless Matthias Nicolau comes out to humble him, but I don't think so. We ride with Asu Almabayev. This is just one of those cards where I feel like I can predict all of these correct or predict all of them wrong. It's going to be a toss-up. After that, we get into our main card, and we kick it off in the men's featherweight division as Darren the Damage Elkins takes on Daniel the Pit Pineda. Darren Elkins, plus 105. Daniel Pineda, minus 130. Wow. Darren, 28-11. Daniel Pineda, 28-16. 3-0 contest, too. 5'10" to 5'7" gives Darren 3 inches in height. He also has 2 inches in reach, 71 to 69. Orthodox stance for both of these gentlemen. Let's start with Darren, 40 years old from Sacramento. Out of Darren's 28 wins, Darren has gotten 15 submissions, 7 by KO, 8 by sub. 4 of his 11 losses have come by KO, and 1 of those by submission. Darren the Damage Elkins has been with the UFC since 2010. Approaching year 15, Darren. Been fighting for over 15 years. You know, he's fought Charles Oliveira, Chad Mendez, Jeremy Stevens. At one point, he was on a 6-fight win streak, which led him to a fight with Alexander Volkanovski, who brutally beat him. He was at one point on a 4-fight losing streak before going on a 2-fight win streak, fighting Cub Swanson, fighting Tristan Connolly, fought Jonathan Pierce. Last time he fought, October last year, where he got a round 3 rear naked chokehold. So Darren Elkins, coming in with some momentum, has been out of action for a year. We're excited to see it back. He brings the bloody fights whenever he is in the octagon. His opponent, Daniel Pineda, the favorite, 39 years old. He's not a spring chicken either. He's from Houston, Texas. Out of his 28 wins, 9 KOs and 19 submissions, a 100% finish rate. Out of his 16 losses, Daniel Pineda has been finished 3 times by KO and 6 times by submission. I always love to see a 100% finish rate at 28 career fights. Incredible. Pineda has been with the UFC since 2012. This is his second stint, you know, from 2012 to 2014. He went 3-4, okay, came back in 2020, got a big win over Herbert Burns, then got knocked out by Cub Swanson, had a no contest against Andre Feely, submitted Tucker Lust, had a fight of the night loss to Alex Caceres, most recently fought in July, lost the decision to Nathaniel Wood. But you know what? Pineda's game, Pineda brings it, and there's just something about this Apex card that I think Pineda is going to shine in. And I'm not even a hater of Darren Elkins. I do enjoy Darren Elkins, but I just think Pineda is going to get this one done. And as I look at Pineda, you know, 9 KOs, 19 subs, I think he gets his 10th career knockout. Okay, I think he does it in round 1. I think he catches Elkins off the bat, clips him with something, lands some TKO ground and pound, and Daniel Pineda gets back in the win column at number 39 of age. I got you. You know what? Battle of the Oldies. We saw it last week. We see it the week before. They're always having these two older guys match up. I like it instead of feeding them to a young up-and-comer. And then here we are. It's currently Wednesday, October 16th, and we actually have a short-notice fight taking place as Jake Hadley was supposed to take on Brady Highstand in the men's bantamweight division. Instead, Jake Hadley will be taking on Cameron Smotherman, who we don't have too much info on. Let me see if I can actually find this guy on. Has he been in the UFC at all? Has he been in? I just Googled Cameron Smotherman record, and I got taken to a freaking criminal database where it lists people's record. Oh my gosh, I need to include MMA behind that or something. Yikes. All right, so he has been in the UFC before. I thought I recognized him. Bam, we have his stats pulled up here. You know I had to come through for Cameron Smotherman. This match taking place at bantamweight, I presume, unless it goes to featherweight, but we'll have to see. Jake White Kong Hadley, 11-3. Cameron, the babyface killer Smotherman, 8-4. 5'7". This is tricky to do. 5'7 to 5'9. Cameron has 2 inches in height over Jake Hadley. 70-inch reach for Jake, 70-inch reach for Cameron, pretty similar. Orthodox stance for Cameron, southpaw for Jake Hadley. I'm trying to pull this up on multiple slides. Jake Hadley, we'll start with this fellow here. 28 years old from England. Of his 11 wins, he has 8 finishes, 3 KOs, and 5 submissions. He's never been finished in all 3 of his losses. Interesting enough, he's coming off a win over Cowlin Lorraine back in July of this year. Before that, he had lost to Charles Johnson in May. This was a guy who was kind of sketchingly, you know, kind of suspiciously given a contract in David's Contreras series. Dana gave him a shot. He actually lost his debut, funny enough, went on a 2-fight finish streak. Then lost to Cody Durden, got by being outgrappled, then got outstruck by Charles Johnson. Was able to beat Cal in the rain, though, so he'll be coming into this one on a 1-fight win streak. His opponent, Cameron Smotherman, 27 years old from Houston, coming out of a 3-fight win streak. Out of his 8 career wins, he has 6 knockouts and 1 submission. Out of his 4 losses in his career, 2 are by knockout, including August 15th, 2023, where he fought on Dana White's Contender Series and was knocked out in a minute by Charlampis Grigiao. And we've learned that Charlampis is not game for the UFC, so pretty funny enough. Cameron, welcome back to the UFC. They're going to give him one more shot, stepping in, short notice, taking on a guy in Jake Hadley who doesn't really offer anything. You know, Hadley, he's gotten a knockout before and 2 years ago. He's gotten a submission 3 years ago almost. I don't know what to make of this one. I feel like this is a fight Hadley wins, but it'd be more fun to pick Cameron Smotherman. I don't really know. I don't really know. You know, Hadley, never been finished. If he does finish him, Cameron would catch him by knockout. He's coming on a little three-fight win streak with two of those being finishes. Oh, this one's tricky. I know I have to pick someone. You have to pick someone, but this is these Apex cards, man. They make these fights unnecessarily close. Hadley doesn't really have the best attitude towards life, I feel. If Cameron Smotherman comes in and gets a grand knockout, that'd be something. But as I picture Twitter, I picture X releasing the info about who won, I don't know if I see Cameron Smotherman winning. I got Jake Hadley by decision, sadly. But if Cameron wins, I will be more than satisfied. More than satisfied with that. But we will go Jake Hadley by decision. Ugh. Just lame. Now, after that, we get into our final flyweight matchup of the evening as Charles Johnson takes on Suma Darji. Charles Energy Johnson, Suma Darji, the Tabishan Eagle, Suma Darji, however you want to phrase his name. This one should be fun. Charles Johnson coming in this one, 16-6. Suma Darji, 16-6 as well. Wow. 5'9 to 5'8. Charles has 1 inch in height, 72 inches to 70, 2 inch reach advantage for Suma Darji. Southpaw for Suma Darji, switch stance for Charles Johnson. The matchmaking is off the charts here. Off the charts. Charles Energy Johnson. Let's start with this guy. Actually, you know what? We're going to start with Suma Darji because I want to talk about Charles Johnson after that. Suma Darji, 16 career wins. He has 13 knockouts and one sub. Love to see it. 28-year-old from China, plus 170 underdog. All six of his losses have come by submission. He was actually supposed to fight Alan Nascimento earlier this year and was actually supposed to fight Joshua Van again earlier this year. Suma Darji, been with the UFC since 2018. He's gone 3-3. Just comically enough, all three of his losses, he's been submitted. He's gotten a knockout of Malcolm Gordon 4 years ago. Last win actually came in January of 2021 over Zaruk Adeshev. Suma Darji, yet to be in the win column now for 3 years, approaching four. You know, that Tim Elliott loss in December of last year wasn't that pretty. Got submitted in round one. I don't know what to expect from this guy, if I'm being honest. But I'll tell you what I do expect from Charles Johnson, and that is domination. That is domination for Charles Johnson, the 33-year-old from Missouri. Out of Charles, 16 wins, 10 finishes, 6 KOs, 4 subs. He's the minus 210 favorite, and he is just on the edge of the rankings. I'm talking, this is a guy, if the rankings were unlimited, he's 16 or 17. Okay, and he's looking to become the first fighter to get 4 victories in 2024. Shockingly ended Ozzyk Maksum's undefeated run with a fight of the night in February of this year, then beat Jake Hadley, who we just mentioned, in May, and then most recently became the first man to knock out Joshua Van with a round three knockout. And 20 seconds into round number three, wow, knocked him out cold with an uppercut. That was in July. Charles Johnson, who at one point was on a three-fight losing streak, was about to be cut, and then beat the undefeated Ozzyk Maksum after losing round one. Incredible. Charles Johnson, he's coming for it. He's hungry. And look at this. Charles actually has 4 career submissions. Suma Darji always loses by submission. I think Charles waits a little bit, maybe until round two or something, and he gets the submission in round number two. We're riding with the energy, Charles Johnson. I went from not picking this guy to being a huge fan of this guy. Charles, let's break into the rankings. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we get into the final two matchups of the evening in our co-main event. We get some ranked bantamweight action as the number 10-ranked Rob Font takes on the number 12-ranked Kyler Phillips. Actually intrigued by this one. This is just great matchmaking. Again, okay, Rob Font, Kyler the Matrix Phillips. Rob is 20-8, Kyler 12-2. Both men are 5'8", 72-inch reach to 71-inch reach, so 1 inch for Kyler Phillips. Both men stand the orthodox stance, plus 215 for Rob, minus 280 for Kyler Phillips. Those odds are a bit high, if you ask me. Let's go with the number 10 bantamweight, Rob Font, to start out, 37 years old, from Boston, Massachusetts. He is from the New England Cartel, of course. Another notable name there is, oh my gosh, what's it, Calvin Kattar. Actually, at one point, Calvin Kattar and Rob Font almost had title shots. It's crazy where they're at now. Of Rob Font's 20 career wins, he has 9 KOs and 4 submissions. Of his 8 losses, he's only ever been submitted once. Crazy enough. Been with the UFC since 2014, 10 years in the biz. He's taken on John Lineker, Matt Schnell, Pedro Munhoz, Rafael Assuncao. He's knocked out Marlon Moraes. He's won on Fight Night over Cody Garbrandt. He's had a fight of the night against Ricky Simon. He's fought in Jose Aldo, Marlon Vera. His last win, April of 2023, where he knocked out Adrian Yanez. Since then, decision loss to Corey Sandhagen, decision loss to Deiveson Figueiredo. But Rob is back. 1-4 in his last 5. I want you all to know those 5 guys that he has lost to. Jose Aldo, Featherweight champion has fought for the Bantamweight championship. Marlon Vera fought for the Bantamweight championship. Corey Sandhagen fought for the interim championship. Devin Figueiredo, former flyweight champion, one fight away from a title shot. So Rob Font has been taking on some absolute killers in the men's bantamweight division, yet is coming into this one 8 years the senior of the Mayas 280 favorite, that is the Matrix, Kyler Phillips. Kyler, of his 12 professional victories, 5 KOs and 2 subs, he is 29 years old from Phoenix. Of his 2 losses, never been finished. And truly, truly, Kyler Phillips should be 7-0 in the UFC, okay? One is Dana White's Contender Series debut on the first season. Came in, fight of the night. After that, performance of the night. After that, beat Song Yedong. Then loses a fight of the night majority decision to Raleem Paiva. And by the way, the judges on Sandhagen and Dillashaw, the worst judges I've ever seen. I don't know what fight they saw, but Kyler Phillips whooped Raleem Paiva's ass. Okay, in every stat category, even we look at damage, Kyler Phillips won. Crazy that he didn't win that. Currently on a 3-fight win streak since then, gotten a triangle armbar, beaten Ryony Barcells, most recently at UFC 299 in March, beat Pedro Munhoz by unanimous decision. I think Kyler Phillips is up next. Rob Font could be the one to humble him. He occasionally does it, but I think that Kyler Phillips has all the tools. And as I look at a guy in Pedro Munhoz who fights a somewhat similar boxing style, maybe even more kicks than Rob Font does, and looking at what Kyler did to him, I'm pretty confident that Kyler Phillips can get this one done. I don't see a finish. I really don't see a finish in this one. But then again, anything's possible. Truly, truly, anything's possible. So we're going to ride with Kyler Phillips. And if he gets a win, he'll be in the top 10. And I'm thinking a rematch with Song Yedong could be in his future. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we get into the main event of UFC Vegas 99. Super exciting. Yay, we're so happy. And it is oddly the best fight of the entire evening. Well, that should make sense. As Anthony Fluffy Hernandez, the number 13th ranked middleweight in the world, takes on the number 14th ranked middleweight, Michelle Demolidor Pereira. This one's going to be good. Anthony, 12-2 with 1 no contest. Michelle Pereira, 31-11 with 2 no contests. 6'1 to 6', gives Michelle 1 inch in height, 2 inches in reach to Anthony, 75-73. Both men stand in the orthodox fighting position. And both men are the same exact age, 31 and 33. Actually, Hernandez's birthday is on freaking this fight night card. Wow. Oh my gosh, that's crazy. No, it's the 18th. His birthday is the day before this card. Wow. Good for you. Let's start with Michelle Pereira, guys. Alrighty, this guy ranked number 14. He is just on the run of a lifetime. The plus 130 underdog from Brazil. 8-fight winning streak. You gotta be kidding me. Of his 31 wins, 11 KOs and 8 subs. Of his 11 losses, he's been finished twice. Last time he was actually finished was 2018. Last time he lost, 2020, which was by disqualification due to an accidental knee on Diego Sanchez. Since then, won 5 straight at welterweight before moving up to middleweight, where since he has won 3 straight fights in a minute. In a minute, okay? October 2023, performance of the night, minute and second knockout, okay? In March of this year, minute rear naked chokehold of Michael Okojasek. In May of this year, 54-second submission of Iyo Portero with a guillotine choke. Domination from this guy. 8 straight fights. Hasn't skipped a beat. I mean, he's had fight of the nights. He's had performance of the nights. Michelle Pereira is coming for that top 10. He is so excited. He's doing backflips on guys. He has the power punching. He has the style. He is here to bring it. But he's running into a bit of a challenge here as he takes on Fluffy Anthony Hernandez, 30 years old, as we mentioned, from California, on a 5-fight win streak. Of his 12 wins, 2 KOs, and 8 submissions. Now, both of his losses, he was finished in, but last time he lost was in 2020 to Kevin Holland. Okay, since then, submission of Rodolfo Vieira, decision Josh Fremm, submission Marc-Andre Bayou, TKOs Edmund Shahbazyan, and he fought earlier this year in February and submitted Roman Kopylov in round number 2 with a rear naked chokehold. Name of the game for Hernandez is takedowns. Okay, this dude is a takedown goblin. Over his last 3 fights, he has accumulated a total of 17 takedowns. Over his last 4 fights, 25 takedowns. On his win streak, 25 in total. I mean, the one fight where he was facing an actual grappler, he submitted the grappler. So Hernandez, more than fit for his first main event. Same goes for Michelle Pereira. This is a striker versus a grappler with both guys having the ability to throw up submissions. Hernandez, you're not going to see the knockout power. Okay, you saw that maybe on Contender Series 7 years ago, but not now. You know, he has completely fallen onto his grappling. Hernandez does have some good power punching when he needs to, but I'm going with Michelle Pereira, who's going to pop Hernandez right off the bat, get the victory. We're going with Michelle Pereira. Also, interestingly enough, these two are actually both supposed to fight on September 14th at the Sphere, but it was moved to the main event of here. Before that, he was supposed to fight Roman Dolidze in June. Before that, he was supposed to fight Ikram Alkhasarev in February. So it has been a year-long journey for this man to get a fight. Hernandez finally taking on Michelle Pereira. And this is a good test. Good test for both of these guys. This is a real test to see, can you defeat someone in the rankings to move up into the top 10? Because whoever wins this is getting a top 10 guy. I promise you that. So, Michelle Pereira all day. I'm a fan of him. I love his style. I love his energy. And, you know, this fight night, I would not expect too much. I would not expect too much from it, guys. I mean, Austin Lane, Robelis, expect a heavyweight knockout. Your three women's fights, Brad, Katona, G. Matsumoto, I would not expect much from those four. Nkalu and Almabayev, I would expect something. Elkins and Pineda, I would expect something. Hadley, Smotherman, not much. Charles Johnson, Sumadarji, I would expect Charles to do good there. Rob Font, Kyler Phillips, you're probably going to see a very technical fight. But Hernandez and Pereira, they're going to make it sloppy. It's going to end in the first 2 to 3 rounds. It's first 1, 2, or 3. I mean, I do not see this going the distance. This should be a fun fight night. I'm hoping. We'll see. But, guys, those are my official UFC Vegas 99 predictions. I mean, if we go, so there's 11 fights on here. If we go 9-2, or wait, actually, we need to go 10-1, and I will be plus 100 on my predictions for 2024. So, fingers crossed, we can get there. I'm excited. But that'll do it, guys. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey, on this ride. I hope it was a good time. You now know my predictions for UFC Vegas 99 for Week 7. You know my thoughts on the Menendez brothers, all the new UFC news, everything in pop culture. You know so many new things now that you've done this, guys. Make this the best day of your life whenever you're listening to this. Make it the best year of your life. Make your life amazing. Well, I'm under the belief right now, you know, as I am almost, you know, halfway through my senior year of college, I'll be entering the world, or a lot of people call it entering the workforce. I don't really see myself entering the workforce. You know, I say do what you love every day, and you'll find a way to make a living off it. And heck, that's what I'm doing with this podcast. We'll see where it brings me. Guys, thank you so much for listening. You are all lovely human beings. I love you all so much. And oh yeah, I'll catch you next time on the Surprise Jab Podcast.